Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection. There's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
When Jesus came down the mountain, he stopped at a level stretch where there were many of his disciples. A large crowd of people was with them from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. Then, raising his eyes to his disciples, he said, "Blessed are you, poor, the reign of God is yours. Blessed are you who hunger, filled you shall be. Blessed are you who are weeping, you shall laugh. Blessed shall you be when men hate you, when they ostracize you and insult you and prescribe your name as evil because of the Son of Man. On the day they do so, rejoice and exult, for your reward shall be great in heaven. Thus it was that their fathers treated the prophets. But woe to you, rich, for your consolation is now. Woe to you who are full, you shall go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, you shall weep in your grief. Woe to you when all speak well of you. Their fathers treated the false prophets in just this way."
When Italians are talking to each other about where they're going to spend their holidays, the conventional question is always, are you going to the sea or the mountains? In our gospel wanderings, we do both. Last week, we were down by the Sea of Galilee, listening to Jesus preaching from Peter's boat. Today, he's gone up the mountain, writes Matthew. But for Luke, he has just come down, after spending the whole night in prayer. When day came, writes Luke, he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles. The distinction between disciple and apostle isn't always made by the evangelists, nor is the specific moment of choice of the 12 the same in their different accounts. But both Luke and Mark write that the appointment of the 12 took place in the hills. Mark writes,
"He now went up into the hills and summoned those he wanted, so they came to him and he appointed 12. They were to be his companions and to be sent out to preach with power to cast out devils."
A clear and simple exposition of what Jesus intended his apostles to be and do. As for what happened on the occasion Luke recounts in today's gospel, we might imagine that Jesus has retired into the hills at night to pray, and that as he comes down in the early morning, he's joined by his closest disciples. Whether this was the moment when he made his final choice doesn't particularly matter, though curiously enough in the Roman Missal version, based on the Jerusalem Bible, the Gospel begins, "Jesus came down with the 12." What does seem to be important is the mountain, writes Jesuit Father Peter Rieger.
The mountain is mentioned since it is a parallel to the original mountain of Mount Sinai, where the first law was given to the chosen people who remained at the foot of the mountain. Christ is here represented as the new Moses who gives the perfect law of the gospel.
Matthew's account stresses this parallel by separating the crowds from Jesus and the 12 he has chosen. He writes, in fact,
"Seeing the crowds, he went up the hill. There he sat down and was joined by his disciples. Then he began to speak. This is what he taught them."
And he begins the Beatitudes. So, in Matthew, as Father Rieger puts it, he sits down and teaches in the custom of Hebrew rabbis.
The crowds remain on the plain, while Christ with his disciples is at a distance from them. It seems that the discourse is directed primarily to the disciples and only incidentally to the crowds. Christ teaches the disciples so that in their turn they might be the witnesses of his good news to the people. They were the ones who were to transmit this message.
And although in Luke Christ teaches the whole crowd surrounded by his disciples, he begins by raising his eyes to his disciples, fixing his eyes on his disciples, runs the Jerusalem Bible version. So in the end, it's always the 12 to whom the message is primarily directed. But what of all that immense crowd gathered there on the hillside, the Mount of the Beatitudes as it's known today? A hill, writes one guide, from which Christ proclaimed his new law of the new kingdom, and from which, the same writer informs us, one can enjoy one of the most wonderful views in Galilee. The view referred to is from a specific point, the shrine, writes another.
In 1936, the Associazione Italiane built on the mountain the beautiful Shrine of the Beatitudes and a hospice next to it. Both institutions are run by the Franciscan Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary. The church, designed by the architect Barlozzi, is octagonal, each of its 8 walls commemorating one of the Beatitudes. The mosaic floor is decorated with symbols of the 7 virtues of man referred to in the sermon. There is a magnificent view of the Sea of Galilee from the church and from the hospice.
And before we join the crowd down on the plain, let's take a look at that view.
From this place one can see successively to the left Capernaum, further on the mouth of the Jordan into the lake, to the east the Wadi Samak with Kursi.
And if Kursi puzzles us, we find an explanation in a modern guidebook.
Kursi, located on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, next to the road that leads up to the Golan Heights, is identified as the country of the Gergesenes, or Gadarenes.
And in the 5th century, a monastery was built there, for early Christian writers and pilgrims, we're told, identified this place as the site of a spectacular miracle, when Jesus sent the demons into the herd of pigs, and they all, some 2,000 of them, rushed wildly down the steep bank and were drowned in the sea. That day on the mount when Jesus preached the Beatitudes was long before that dramatic episode which was to take place on the other side of the lake. But when he looked over in that direction that day, did Jesus foresee anything extraordinary? Both Luke and Matthew recount that it happened after the storm on the lake, almost as if the elements themselves were giving a warning of the evil presence on the other side. A fanciful idea, certainly. But after all, it was Jesus who said to the disciples, "Let us cross over to the other side of the lake." They didn't ask why, and he didn't say, so we may only imagine. If we were to visit the Mount of the Beatitudes today, we might find this piece of information useful. We know it is on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee above Capernaum, but we're told it is approached by a special road branching from the Tiberias Rosh Pina Road. I haven't been able to identify Rosh Pina, but Tiberias was the magnificent town founded by Herod to minister to his summer palace on the hill, as one writer puts it. In our Lord's time, of course, there would have been no special road leading to the mountain, which today is crowned by its shrine. There would have been a road along by the lake, though, from Capernaum to Tiberias, some 10 miles to the south, if only because of its hot baths. The spring of hot mineral water nearby was mentioned by Pliny, and in the time of Jesus attracted sick people from all over the country, which gave one writer cause to reflect.
One cannot help marvelling at the number of sick people who were brought to the lakeside to be cured by Jesus. At times they came to him not singly, but in great companies. One imagines that the presence of the most famous spa in the country and the gathering there of many hundreds of invalids must have been responsible for many of the crowds who sought our Lord's help in Capernaum.
It's an interesting thought. Certainly that day in June, when Jesus came down the hill and stopped at a level stretch, there were not only many of his disciples, but with them a large crowd of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coast of Tyre and Sidon. And if we read on, Luke writes that these people had come to hear him and to be cured of their diseases. And so there they all are on that grassy slope, some sitting, some standing, probably some disabled or crippled, propped up on litters or leaning on able friends, all straining to listen to what the prophet had to say, hoping for words of comfort, encouragement, and in many cases, no doubt, hoping for a miraculous cure. And Luke writes,
"Even those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and everyone in the crowd was trying to touch him, because power came out of him that cured them all."
Immediately before his account of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew writes of Jesus curing all kinds of diseases and sickness among the people.
"Painful complaints of one kind or another, the possessed, epileptics, the paralyzed, were all brought to him, and he cured them."
And his fame spread throughout Syria, Matthew tells us, and large crowds followed him, coming from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and Transjordania. And so between them, Luke and Matthew have told us that the people have come from all four points of the compass. Syria is to the north, Jerusalem and Judea to the south, Tyre and Sidon to the west on the Mediterranean, the Decapolis, the 10 Greek towns, to the east, on the other side of the lake. And Father Rieger comments,
"The crowds are not only Jews, but also people from Syria and the surrounding regions, which presumably includes pagans. Thus the future universal nature of the missionary vocation of the disciples to all peoples is here implied. Through the disciples, Christ addressed himself to the whole world."
So we are all there. And though we may have to listen to the words of Jesus, not on a hill by a lake, but in a poorly heated church, with people fidgeting, children crying, distractions innumerable, perhaps we can visualize what it was like to hear those words when they were spoken for the first time. It was June, and it reminds me of lovely June days long ago, when as a student in London, there was the occasional treat of an outside lecture, sitting on the grass by the lake in Regent's Park. We had our distractions too, but so did those listeners in Galilee. They would have heard the shouts of the fishermen down by the lake and the crunching of the boats on the pebbly shore as they were pushed out into the deep. But the voice from the hill must have been nothing short of hypnotic. And when they returned to their homes, some far, far away, surely the memory of that day would have accompanied them for the rest of their lives. And for the pagans in particular, it must have been rather like the way Eliot imagines the return of the Magi to their kingdoms.
"No longer at ease here, in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods."
In the memory of those who first heard the Beatitudes, and it could be in ours, there might persist something like this.
"Always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway, or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core."
Yeats, of course. When we compare the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, there are numerous differences in the presentation of the Beatitudes. At first glance, Luke, with his four blessings and four curses, is apparently at odds with Matthew, who lists eight, even nine, blessings. But Luke is only following a literary form common in the Old Testament, such as in the Psalms, where happiness comes to the man who does good and the contrary to the one who does evil, as we heard in the first reading today.
"Happy indeed is the man who follows not the counsel of the wicked, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord. All that he does shall prosper. Not so are the wicked, not so, for they, like winnowed chaff, shall be driven away by the wind."
Scholars explain that this sharp contrast between the virtuous and the wicked is characteristic of Hebrew thought.
"It was essentially geared to the training of youth, or the art of living well, based on the experience of the older generation. The blessing or the curse is usually dependent upon some condition which must be fulfilled. When Luke says, 'Woe to you that are rich, for you have received your consolation,' the curse, of course, is dependent upon condition that the rich continue to be greedy and selfish. Implicit in the condemnation is a certain appeal to penance. So too with regard to the blessing. He will continue to be blessed as long as he continues to be meek, patient, merciful, etc.
And in both Luke and Matthew, the most powerful promise is in the Beatitude referring to persecution. As the scholars tell us, Christ is preparing the apostles for their mission to the world.
Just as the prophets, who were the messengers of faith to the world, were persecuted because of the word, so too with the apostles and the disciples of Christ. The follower of Jesus goes to a world with different values from his, under the influence of evil. The struggle between the two is inevitable. Yet, throughout this persecution runs the theme of joy, of imitating Christ. Joy in the midst of persecution is a Christian paradox.
And it was St. Francis of Assisi, the man who was once called the only perfect Christian, who taught Brother Leo that perfect joy is only in the cross.
Happy are you when people hate you, drive you out, abuse you, denounce your name as criminal on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice when that day comes and dance for joy, for then your reward will be great in heaven.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert, Joan Lewis, sat down with me to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days. So it's good morning again, Joan. Welcome back.
On this rainy day, it's been so cold and rainy. Today isn't as cold, but I'm a little tired of the rain. And it's a holiday.
And it's a holiday.
We're not even supposed to be sitting here doing
this
show.
Absolutely. We're meant to be celebrating the Lateran Pact.
The Lateran Pact. This is the 81st anniversary of the creation of Vatican City State. So it's the Vatican's Independence Day, if you will. The agreement with the state of Italy in 1929 on this very day, which created the independent. I mean, physically, it was the same as it is now, but it became independent on that day. And various agreements, because, of course, this was in compensation for the Papal States, which was actual physical territory run by and owned by the Church. And the Papal States were confiscated to form what we know today as the Republic of Italy. It was then the Kingdom. And the Church never got compensated for the very vast holdings that were confiscated from them. So that happened in 1929. And as I said, Vatican City State became independent, plus there was a monetary compensation from the state of Italy, and here we are today.
And the legislation still holds today.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Legally,
exactly.
Politically.
Exactly. One or two little things have been changed, but nothing nothing major. And also the World Day of the Sick with Mass by the Holy Father in St. Peter's Basilica, which was preceded by another prayer service. So it's very interesting because if you look at the World Day of the Sick, we're talking about life. We're talking about healing. And this was actually, if you look back at a number of things earlier in the week, a week kind of dedicated to life. And
that's
it just,
right.
If you start even with
that's
the
right.
Angelus, you've
Sunday.
Got the Holy Father talking about last Sunday's celebration in Italy of the Day for Life. And the message was interesting. The theme of the day was the power of life, a challenge in poverty. And the Pope talked about how in the current economic difficulty, these mechanisms that cause poverty and create social inequality, they wound and offend life, striking above all, as we all well know, the weakest and the most defenseless. And he said, you know, we've got to overcome this poverty and need. And he said, I loved this line. He said, man's destiny is not well-being, but God himself, and human existence must be defended and favored in all of its stages. And once again, he said, no one is the owner of his life. You almost want to repeat those words. But we're called to care for it and respect it from the moment of conception until natural death. And this was kind of a prelude, really, to Monday's meeting. The Holy Father met the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for the Family. And he mentioned several projects that they're going to be doing and are currently doing, and also remarked on a very, very important one that they're about to undertake, which is a Vade Mecum, which, by the way, is a Latin. It's a guide, and it's a term used a lot here. I think sometimes we take it for granted. But if I were to go to the States, for example, and say something about a Vade Mecum, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. But here it's used a lot in Italian, even in English. And it comes from the Latin meaning go with me. And it is very much an authoritative guide. And so the council is preparing a guide on the preparation for marriage, which ought to be very, very fascinating, how much this Pope and his predecessor, John Paul, spoke about marriage, a union between a man and a woman, speaking about children, speaking about the family being the most important cell of society.
On Tuesday, there was an important communique by the Secretary of State, wasn't there?
There was, and it's one of those things where you almost have to take the time of a show to go into the background of this. But basically, in a really small nutshell, the Vatican, the Holy See, came out with this communique from the Secretary of State refuting the claims that the Holy See is responsible for, behind the scenes, the resignation of the editor of a newspaper called Avvenire, which is owned by the Catholic Bishops of Italy. And that editor resigned in September. Avvenire had basically come out with statements about Prime Minister Berlusconi, about his personal life, so forth and so on. And Avvenire owned by the bishops. Now, the Vatican newspaper, of course, had been very reluctant to, like, attack the Prime Minister for his personal life, and they hadn't done that. But a newspaper owned by the Berlusconi family came out and attacked the attack by Avvenire, and they came out with their own thing that the editor might have had homosexual tendencies, and he resigned. And that seemed
this
possibly
has been brewing in the background throughout.
Oh,
the
sure,
months.
For a long time, and that seemed possibly to have been put to rest when I think it was last week. The editor of this same Berlusconi family-owned paper came out and said that it was actually some high-ranking people in the Vatican that had furnished the proof for this. So with that. And I am really putting in a nutshell, you know, months and months of news. With that in mind, the statement that the communique that the Secretariat of State came out with essentially basically denies this and said it was false, that any officers of the gendarmerie or the editor of the Osservatore Romano passed on documents which lay behind the resignation of the editor of Avvenire. It's false that this editor of the Vatican paper in any way transmitted or endorsed information and so forth. And basically, this statement really condemns the proliferation of what they call the most incredible assertions and hypotheses repeated by the media with truly remarkable consonance, that everything rests on unfounded convictions with the intention of gratuitously and calumniously attributing to the editor of the Osservatore Romano an unmotivated, unreasonable, and malicious action. And they also mention that what has been written goes so far as to insinuate the responsibility of the Cardinal Secretary of State. So now there are no names mentioned. There are positions mentioned in this, but no names. And I think the part that really kind of, you know, pulls at your heartstrings is at the very end. It says, you know, this is giving rise to a defamatory campaign against the Holy See, which even involves the Roman pontiff. And the message ends, the Holy Father Benedict XVI, who has been kept constantly informed, deplores these unjust and injurious attacks, renews his complete faith in his collaborators, and prays that those who have the good of the church at heart may work with all means to ensure that truth and justice prevail.
Now, on to Wednesday, which is the usual weekly general audience. in which the Pope's trip to Malta was announced, or the itinerary.
The itinerary was announced, right? Yes. And as a matter of fact, I don't know how many people are aware of it, but there were two trips made public. The Holy See made public the itinerary of the Pope's trip on April 17th and 18th to Malta. And it's interesting. He leaves on the 17th, which will be a day after his birthday.
Oh, right.
And he returns on the 18th, which is the day before the fifth anniversary of his election to the papacy. He arrives in Malta on mid-afternoon the 17th. He goes to, has a private visit there at this grotto of St. Paul. Malta's a very small island. It's just slightly over like 400,000 people. 98% of them are Catholics, and it's like 97 of that 98% are practicing Catholics. It's phenomenal. There's over 360 churches in Malta.
Goodness me.
And it's composed of 20 islands. Only three are inhabited: Gozo, Comino, and Malta. And
the capital is La Valletta.
La Valletta, right. After Jean de La Valette. And but it's an amazingly small island, but kind of a crossroads right there.
Right. It was very strategic during World War II.
World War II, I mean, from the past 1,000 years. So it's a small island, but a very, very Catholic, a bastion of the Catholic religion. And so a day and a half, actually, if you look at it, it's going to be a little over 24 hours, that trip. But the other trip that was announced, but not by the Vatican, the bishops of Portugal put up their website for the Pope's visit, which is basically his name, Benedict the 16th, but in Portuguese, and it says BenedictTheSixteenthPortugal.org. And right now, you do have to speak Portuguese because it's only in the one language. So that ought to be interesting. And that's in May.
Visit to Fatima.
Right.
And
that's
Marian's shrine there.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's for 4 days in May. And then the audience, to go back to the audience, was actually very interesting. You know, the Pope's been talking about medieval Christian culture, and we've heard him talk about St. Francis. We heard him talk last week about St. Dominic. And this past week, he talked about St. Anthony of Padua, a contemporary of St. Francis's. And it's very interesting. He was born, they figure, around 1195. And speaking of Portugal, he was born in Lisbon. And he was an Augustinian canon. Then he entered the Friars Minor because he wanted to travel as a missionary. He got very ill, returned to Italy, where he actually dedicated himself to apostolic labors. He died in Padua in 1231, which is why the whole world has called him St. Anthony of Padua and not actually his birth country. And he was canonized by Pope Gregory the Ninth just a year later. And so that's how, in those days, it was very common to do almost what people did for John Paul when he died, and they said Santo Subito, make him a saint immediately. It was called Vox Populi.
I had no idea.
And to proclaim the sanctity of someone, the people, those who knew him, who dealt with him, who had contact with them, they would often, the voice of the people spoke, they would say Santo Subito, and you can see only a year lapsed between Anthony's death and his canonization.
And that brings us to the end of an eventful week and looking forward to the beginning of Lent, because next Wednesday is Ash Wednesday.
Next week is, and I will be celebrating Ash Wednesday in northern Iraq. So,
goodness me, Joan. You're going to northern Iraq?
I'm going to northern Iraq. I will be in Iraq from the 15th till the 22nd, and then back in Beirut, where my flights take me from Rome to Beirut to Erbil in the north of Iraq. And a invitation from the bishops there to report on the situation of the suffering Christians who are leaving. So,
all the best for your trip. Do take care.
We'll try and be in touch.
We look forward to speaking to you.
I look forward to returning.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.